Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund intelligence. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our U.S. Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. We're excited to have a special guest on with us today, Dr. Brad Case from Middleburg Communities. Brad Case, PhD, CFA, CAIA, is Chief Economist for Middleburg Communities, a full-service developer, builder, and manager of rental housing communities. Dr. Case provides analytical support for C-level, buy, sell, develop, and market-focused tactical decisions. Dr. Case has researched residential and non-residential real estate markets domestically and globally for more than 30 years. Prior to Middleburg Communities, he worked as an economist with Fannie Mae, Nareit, and the Federal Reserve Board. Dr. Case earned degrees from Williams College and the University of California at Berkeley and his PhD in economics at Yale University, where he worked with Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller. Dr. Case, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's very much my pleasure. Thank you.
Omar, I'll kick it over to you to get us started.
Sure. Dr. Case, I would love to get a bit about your background. So what really sparked your interest in economics and particularly within the real estate sector to begin with?
It sounds awfully geeky, but I first got interested in the economics of real estate when I was in high school. And interestingly, it was because where I was growing up, which was Honolulu, Hawaii, they had what's called a land value tax system, which is currently under consideration, under discussion in Minnesota. But at that time, my understanding was that the only other place that had a land value tax system was Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I was fascinated by the idea that Hawaii was doing something almost unique within the country that was designed to cause better use of land. I could have gone in so many different directions. So it really wasn't until I was at Berkeley getting a master's degree that it really crystallized my interest in the economics of real estate, working with a terrific professor named John Quigley on house prices at a time when the economy in Japan was soaring and Japanese investors were making huge investments in, again, my home, Honolulu, Hawaii, buying up houses. And so I was studying the effect of that increase in demand from Japan on house prices in Honolulu. And that was sort of the start of my adult interest in real estate economics.
Fantastic. And you've had a path that I would say not many can say that they've shared the same direction, going through academia to the public sector, to the private sector. Can you share a little bit about some of those pivotal moments that made you jump from one area to the next?
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with being part of a couple. When I finished my degree at Berkeley, I got married very shortly after that, and my lovely wife was in law school. And so I was fortunate to get a teaching position at the College of William & Mary on a visiting basis until she finished law school. If I had any doubt about getting a PhD in economics, that really set me on my path. And incidentally, a couple of my students at William & Mary became very prominent economists, including focusing on real estate. So that's very gratifying. And then we moved back to the Washington, D.C. area, where she has worked ever since. So the rest of my path was really determined by sort of our joint location decision. When I went to get my PhD up at Yale, she stayed where she was. And so we were apart for the first 2 years of that program. And I've been in Washington, D.C. ever since. Now, the thing about Washington, D.C. is it's a terrific place to be an economist, partly because there are good opportunities both in the private sector and with government agencies. So I was able to have good opportunities as an economist. Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of academic institutions, and so I was not able to spend my career teaching because the academic institutions weren't hiring in my fields at the times that I was looking at jobs. It's hard to predict how your career is going to go. I've been very fortunate. I've had a very pleasant career, but it could have gone in any of several different directions, depending on what had happened with that joint location decision.
And is there any particular area that you have felt as though that's the spot you felt most comfortable in?
No, you know, the thing is, being an economist, you learn a set of techniques for analyzing data of certain types, and you can apply that in several sort of fields. So for example, in an earlier part of my life, I worked as a consultant, mainly doing projects for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. But at the same time, I was occasionally working on projects having to do with cement kiln dust, a pollutant, or looking for oil deposits. So I have applied the skills that I have as an economist in several fields. But in terms of, you know, within real estate, I have moved comfortably between owner-occupied housing, rental housing, non-residential income-producing real estate. It's really a set of ways of looking at the economy that are continually of interest to me, and I'm able to apply my skills across that entire set of property types.
Dr. Case, on that note, you're now at Middleburg Communities. Do you want to give us an overview of what the company does, maybe where it fits in the current real estate landscape?
Yeah. Middleburg, we just celebrated our 20th anniversary. What we do is sort of soup to nuts. We look for pieces of land that we think would be good to develop into rental housing communities. We develop those communities. We build them. We invest in them on behalf of other people. We sometimes invest in other people's developments. We manage our communities. What we're looking at is rental housing communities of generally 250 or so units. And that may be a multifamily community with 10 or 12 buildings in it. And each building has four stories and elevators and air-conditioned corridors and things like that. Or it may be built to rent, which is to say single-family rental housing, but within the same sorts of communities with the same sorts of amenities. And it's not luxury housing. Some of it is what we call workforce housing, so more affordable. But typically, we're right in the middle, what we call middle market class A. So our rental households will be people who work in, they're teachers, they work in hospitals, they may be first responders. They are people who have jobs, but they're not investment bankers. They're looking for a good place to live, not a place to show off how wealthy they are. And so most of our developments are in the southeastern and mid-Atlantic part of the country, growing cities like Charlotte, North Carolina, or Orlando, Florida. And typically we won't be in the downtown area because that's where there will be high rises, and that's not what we build. We're building in more suburban parts of those areas where people are looking for schools that are good for their children to go to. And they're typically looking for a place where they will live for several years. They're not necessarily renting until they can buy a house. They like renting. And so the idea is that they're going to find a place that they will want to live in a rental housing community with amenities for a long time.
Excellent. So your role there is chief economist. You can answer this question however you like, but I guess how does your role contribute to the company? What do you do on a typical day or week to contribute to that mission and your sort of niche in the housing sector?
So I think of my job in three parts. First of all, it's very, very rare for a company like mine to have an economist at all. If they do have somebody that they call their economist, then it's probably somebody who took an undergraduate class. It's very, very rare for them to have somebody with a PhD from a top quality program like Yale's. So I do sort of three things. One is that I help them understand the macroeconomic situation, which gives us a basis for deciding how aggressive we want to be in terms of starting up new developments. Maybe we want to be aggressive in terms of buying other people's properties that already are in operation or selling our properties. For example, this morning I have been updating my recession forecasting model. I predict the probability of recession five times each month, depending on new data that comes out. We use that to help us understand the environment that we're likely to be operating in over the next few years. A second piece of the job, very important, is deciding where to look for pieces of land to develop new rental housing communities. And so for that purpose, I have a machine learning model with a huge amount of data. I evaluate 200,000 locations throughout the country. And in our land acquisition team, we'll look at my analyses and say, all right, if we're interested in expanding into a particular market, which parts of that market should we be looking at for pieces of land to develop? The idea is to cut down the number of misses, you know, where we found a piece of land, but it turns out not to be a very good piece to develop what we do. And the third part is, as I said, it's very rare for a company to have the kind of empirical analysis capability that mine does. And so part of my job is simply to make that evident by publishing things online, by speaking, you know, in television or radio interviews, by doing podcasts, making it clear that there is a lot of value if you have the capability to analyze the data that are available in real estate. So a lot of value in making better use of that data to provide better returns to your investors.
So do you find yourself collaborating with teams across acquisitions, development, and portfolio management?
I'm providing the land acquisition team the targets. Look here, look there. If a piece of land becomes available, here's a quick way to evaluate how appealing it should be to us. Then the next step in the development process will be for different people in our company to start to underwrite a possible development on that piece of land. So for example, we can take any piece of land anywhere in the country, in an urban part of anywhere in the country, and say, all right, if we built our property there, what kind of rent do we think we would get? So very quickly, they can say, we're not going to be able to build cheap enough in that location to get the kind of rent, to get the kind of return that we need to make a project successful. So let's say no to this piece of property, this piece of land right away. Or in another place, yeah, you know, if we built there, we would get killer rents, but it's really the kind of place where somebody would be developing a luxury high rise. And again, it may be appealing for development, but not for my company. So sort of at every stage of figuring out whether a development works and whether it's appealing for us to continue in the process of fleshing it out and getting the permitting and buying the land and starting construction, at every stage, I need to be providing information for people to say, all right, yeah, this still looks like a good project. Or this one, yeah, let's not spend much time continuing to evaluate that one because I don't think in the end it's going to work. So the idea is to reduce the number of misses and increase the number of hits.
You mentioned your machine learning model, and we're the research team here at Altus. We use a lot of public data, data that we have internally, data that we create. Are you using any other tools that help with some of this decision making, or do you want to tell us a little bit more about that model?
Our basic philosophy is either we pay for somebody else to do empirical analysis, or we do it ourselves. And so the purpose of hiring me is that we want to do it ourselves and be better than everybody else. Because if you're buying somebody else's analysis, you don't have any competitive advantage over them. If you're doing better analysis in-house, then you do have a competitive advantage. And so, yes, we use publicly available data. Yes, we use data from our own developments, but that's not enough. So the goal is to make better use of the data that are available from sources that other people could get their hands on as well. From my machine learning model, for example, we do make use of forecasts that come from a couple of vendors. We make use of data that come from the Census Bureau. We make use of data that we compile from publicly available sources that are dispersed, that we have to work to collect those data. And so those are data that other people could potentially get their hands on, but they don't have the capability of doing it, and we do. And so when we estimate our machine learning model, we're using, 30 or 40 variables. And as I said, generating an understanding of conditions in 200,000 locations nationwide in urban and suburban areas. So the machine learning model is, you know, it took some work to develop it. It's not difficult to implement. And one of the things that we do is we set things up so that we can update our analyses anytime we want. We do update them every quarter, and we publish a quarterly report at our website and giving some of the insight that comes out of our machine learning model. But for example, one of the inputs into that is what's called a hedonic rent model. And the idea there is we look at the rents that are being paid and or asked for units throughout the country. We say, all right, what are the characteristics of the unit or of the community that it's in? Or the location that it's in, that determine how much people are willing to pay for that particular unit. And we collect data. We have millions of data points, and we have a model that incorporates about 300 measures of things that will affect what people are willing to pay for that rent and so for that unit. And so when I say that we can look at any piece of land in the country and say, if we built what we build there, this is the rent that I think we would get. It comes from that kind of modeling. Again, we're not using data that aren't available to everybody, but very few people have the kind of modeling capabilities to make use of the data that are available.
So if you had to put a stamp on it, do you think that those analytical capabilities are what differentiates Middleburg from other players in your space?
There's no question. It is not the only thing that differentiates Middleburg. We have a terrific construction team, but that includes pre-construction. So we're not, when prices on certain construction materials go up, we're going to be less surprised than other people. We have a better capability of understanding the vulnerabilities. And so sometimes when we invest in somebody else's development, it's because they didn't have the same capabilities that we did. Something happened. They got in trouble. They turned to us for help, and we were able to help them. So the idea is to reduce the number of risks that we face. And it's not just the construction part of the process that accomplishes that, but throughout the company, the idea is to be a little bit better at evaluating conditions, and so that we're not surprised when conditions change in a way that doesn't favor people. One of the things is that, you know, interest rates have gone up over the last few years. If you're not prepared for that, you get in trouble. We were prepared for it. So it has not reduced our level of activity, because we were both looking for that kind of a change in market conditions and prepared to deal with that kind of a change in market conditions. So that's what differentiates Middleburg. It's not just the chief economist. It's throughout the company, but I certainly do contribute to that.
So I'll ask one more before I hand it back to Omar to jump into sort of the macro and market context, but a bit of a transition question. So when we talked on our prep call, we're talking a little bit about some of the drivers for build-to-rent community demand. You want to expand on that a little and tell us what's driving this and what some of those factors are?
Yeah. To simplify things for just a little bit, for decades, the two options have been four walls and some grass, which you got by buying, or renting, which meant living in a multifamily property. There are plenty of people who want to rent four walls and some grass. That was not an option. If it was an option at all, it was you rented from the idiot who lived a couple of blocks away. And when the toilet overflowed, you might or might not get the idiot's attention. What we've been part of here at Middleburg Communities is the development of this new option, build to rent. And it's important to talk about how build to rent is not the only form of single family rental housing. Build to rent means something that is developed as a rental community with the amenities that renters are used to having in their multifamily communities, but with four walls and grass. So it's not scattered site rental housing that you're renting from somebody who has a truck running around from house to house to fix the toilets and fix the washing machines. It's renting from a community that is run as a community right there, with the repair and maintenance staff right on hand and the property managers right on hand. But it's also not just a bunch of houses that were really built to be sold, but they haven't been able to sell them. And so they're renting them until they can sell them. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a bunch of people who want to be renting together, but as I said, with four walls and a yard and some grass and all of the other amenities that come with high quality rental housing communities. Now, what does that mean? What it means is that your tenants are going to be a little bit, on average, a little bit older, because these are people who have chosen, they want to continue renting, and they've moved into the house that fits that stage of their life, but that enables them to continue renting. They're more likely to have children, but most importantly, they're more likely to stay where they are. So the industry is so new that we're still collecting the data. But what we've started to see is that the people who move into the build-to-rent communities that we've developed are tending to renew. They're more likely to renew. They're staying longer in their rental housing because they have found what they want, which is their four walls, their grass in the yard, and their continued ability to rent and have somebody else fix the toilet and fix the dishwasher. It's really a very interesting industry because it's brand new. and we are part of this. And it really has opened up an option that people didn't used to have.
You mentioned that they're older. Would you assign a certain generation to it? Is it predominantly Gen X that's fitting that or not?
No, it's not a matter of when you were born. It's a matter of how old you are, because typically what we used to see was that renters were people who had not yet bought. And it's not that they wanted to buy, it's that they wanted four walls. So yep. What is it that makes you start to want four walls? It's children. That's not the only reason. But for a lot of people, the transition from renting to owning was the same as the transition from not having children to having children. And of course, marriage is typically part of that. So what we are seeing is that if you have reached the stage of your life where, yeah, you may have gotten married, yes, you may have had children, and you've reached a stage in your career where you want to stay in one place for a longer period of time, those are the people who want the four walls and the grass. And so, as I said, you know, what we're offering them is, yeah, we'll give you all of that and you get to be a renter. And incidentally, it's important to note that generally speaking, people who want to build wealth do it better by renting than by owning. It's a myth that buying a house is the way to build wealth. The way to build wealth is to not spend so much money, not put that huge chunk of money into buying a house, but instead put it into the stock market and invest your way to wealth rather than live in a house and pay a mortgage and hope that makes you wealthy.
Do you rent or own?
I do own.
Sorry, just wanted to check.
I often tell people there is exactly one reason to own, and that is because that's the house you want to live in, and you can't live in it unless you buy it. There is one other reason to own, and that's because you're married and your spouse wants to buy that house. That was absolutely my situation.
Yeah, and it seems like those joint decisions that you've made have gotten you to where you are now, and it's a pretty good track record. But taking a step back and looking at the macro and market context, you've been through and you've analyzed and researched multiple real estate cycles.
Yeah.
So how would you make sense and how would you characterize the current market environment?
The current market environment worries me quite a bit. The biggest worry that I have is how overvalued the stock market is. And I remember when I was at the Federal Reserve Board, so I started in April of 2000, I left in August of 2006. So I left before the great financial crisis, which started with mortgages. And I and many other economists at the Fed were very worried about that. We were trying to get lenders to cut back on how aggressive they were at lending on mortgages, not just for single family houses, but for commercial properties as well. There was a lot of pushback from those banks. So we were not able to put the lid on that before everything fell apart. But I remember having a conversation while I was at the Fed about the fact that we had seen a very severe real estate downturn in the early 1990s. And after that was over, people were saying, well, we've learned from that. It won't happen again. Well, of course it'll happen again. And here's how it happens again. The people who learned either retire or become too senior to be making day-to-day decisions. And they are replaced by people who were at the time too young to have learned from the previous crisis. So we saw people making the same mistakes. And when we talked to them about, you know, what happened back in the early 90s, they were busily saying, no, that can't happen again. Things are different now. They're not. People respond to the same incentives. And at that time, the incentive was the party's on. We want to be part of the party. And that's exactly what I'm seeing right now with the stock market. The people who are most energized by the valuations in the stock market are people who didn't learn from previous stock market crashes, like the one that followed the dot-com bubble. And so right now, I'm not so much worried about the real estate market as I was before the great financial crisis. I'm not so much worried about mortgages, whether it's owner-occupied housing or commercial real estate. What I am worried about is a collapse in the stock market, much like what we saw after that dot-com boom of the late 1990s.
You were going against the consensus in early 2022, saying that there was you didn't see a recession. But what I'm hearing now is that you think that the stock market is broadly overvalued. And I know the stock market and the economy aren't necessarily the same thing, They can certainly move separately. And you also mentioned that you rerun your recession model 5 times a quarter. Has your expectation for recession or the likelihood of a recession changed since that early 2022 when you didn't see anything on any recession on the horizon? And if that has changed, what's really driving the results, whether it is for a call of a recession or a call that will be able to avoid a recession?
Yeah. So I'll tell you how my recession forecasting model works. It's got 12 or 13 variables. And all of these are indicators for which I have data going back monthly, back to the early 1960s. Recessions just aren't frequent enough for us to be making any sort of confident assessment based on what we've seen over the last 2 or 3 recessions. We need to get data that encompass several recessions. One of those variables is the state of the stock market, but it's actually the least important variable in my model. So it is relevant, but it is not as relevant as the other variables. For example, some of the most recent data that came out that is part of my recession forecasting model was about housing permits and housing starts in both the single family and the multifamily parts of the market. The most recent data on housing permits was very strong, but the most recent data on housing starts was much weaker. And that is more important. And therefore, the probability of recession has increased in my model. But that's not all. The model is based on data, and I report what the model tells me. But as an economist, I also make judgments about what I think is likely to happen in the future to that data. So my model is not based on my gut. It's not based on my projecting what the data is going to show. The model itself is based only on what the data actually show, and then I apply my judgment on top of that. So when I say that I'm worried about the state of the overall economy, it's separate from my model, which puts the probability of recession in the next 12 months at only about 7%. Starting 3 years ago, there were other people talking about recession is coming, and I was saying, no, I don't see that. And that's because it wasn't in the data, and I didn't see the data shaping up that way. So at times, my model suggested a much higher probability of recession, above 50%. But I still was, in my own judgment, I was skeptical that the likelihood of recession was that high. I thought that the data would turn around, and it did. My concern right now is that the data is going to turn around in a different direction. So as I said, the stock market is the least important variable in my model. But if the stock market tanked, then that would certainly show up in the variable, in the model. My bigger concern, though, is consumption and income growth, and therefore employment growth, which is one of the most important variables in my model. If people are concerned about whether their job is going to be eliminated, they'll stop consuming right away. They'll cut back on what they're buying. That will cause companies to cut back on their hiring. So that's how you move into a recession, is that people get concerned about their own financial future, and they start making decisions that affect the rest of the economy. And when I look at the overall state of the economy right now, I see a lot of concern about federal government policy having to do especially with tariffs and with immigration that are likely to affect the broad economy and that are likely to cause people to cut back on their spending. That's what concerns me about moving into a recession.
And one area that I know the commercial real estate industry has been highly focused on has been the prospect of interest rate reductions or rates really coming down. And I know that in our prep call, you said, hold up, not so fast. What kind of drives your kind of contrarian view on low rates being the panacea or the save all for commercial real estate?
Well, you know, back in September of 2024, the Federal Reserve cut rates for the first time in several years. And just before that meeting, I made a forecast that was wrong. My forecast was that the Federal Reserve would not cut rates. And I said they should not cut rates. And I think that part was right. They should not have cut rates. And so I think they made a mistake by cutting rates in September and again in November. The reason is that I don't think inflation is behind us. the inflationary pressures are still there. We're seeing that in some of the inflation data that have come out since then. And again, I mentioned my concern about tariffs. Tariffs unquestionably are another inflationary pressure. So when I say that I'm concerned about recession, I'm also concerned about reigniting inflation, and that equals stagflation. So that is very much a concern of mine. More generally, though, I think that in general, the idea of cutting interest rates is to stimulate the economy by causing people to invest more. Building housing is a form of investment. And so people who are in the business of developing and building housing, like my own company, love it when interest rates are low because it makes it easier for them to do what they like to do. Now, I mentioned that the difference between Middleburg and many other developers is that we have empirical capability. We have capabilities generally that other companies don't have, which means that we can continue doing what we do even when interest rates are high. Plenty of other people can't. There are lots of people who are developers only when interest rates are low. And they can't continue to be developers when interest rates get high. They simply don't have the capabilities. I'm not in favor of creating the conditions where any idiot can get into the business, because they do. I would prefer to be in the business at a time when the conditions sweep out the idiots and leave those of us who are really capable of operating in any sort of environment. So I'm not in favor in general of low interest rates. When I was in college, I remember doing a paper about how it was that South Korea became a very highly developed economy. And they went through a period when they were trying to stimulate economic development by keeping interest rates very low. And so every idiot wanted to get their hands on low interest rates. And they had lots of really bad projects that they were trying to get funding for. And there was a lot of corruption, because if you could get your hands on the cheap money, then you could make a profit even if your investment was bad. Then that didn't work for South Korea. Then they went through a different period when their strategy instead was let interest rates go up and let people and make people compete by showing that their projects were the ones that were really good. That's when the South Korean economy really started to take off. And that's, I think, what every economy needs, is to have a macroeconomic environment where it's not easy to do investment, but if you've got a good investment, you can make it happen. And that's the situation that we have been in for several years. And I don't think that we want to be moving into an overstimulative market environment, especially when we still have inflation pressures to worry about.
So, Dr. Casey, you said one of the kind of pillars of your work is this kind of external analysis, appearing on podcasts like this one. And I know you've covered a lot of different topics: market cycles, real estate as an inflation hedge, public-private market difference, volatility. So I guess I want to hear, are any of these topics still interesting to you today? And if not, is there one that you're now focused on?
One of the things that I'm focused on right now is what's called revenue management. Just the process of figuring out how much you should be asking to rent in rent for your units. There's been a lot of discussion recently about algorithms. The idea is that companies are using inside information, are sharing inside information for the purpose of setting rents. And I think that's absolutely false. But the only reason that companies are connected together in that process is because individual companies don't know how to do it. And so they hire outside experts who can do it for them. For a company like Middleburg that has the empirical analysis capabilities that we have, there's no reason for us to be doing that. And therefore, we are not doing that. We need to do a better job of figuring out ourselves what are the rental market conditions. And that's been very important recently, because there's been so much disruption in housing generally, not just rental housing. So when the COVID shutdown started, we saw a huge surge of people who wanted to rent in places where they didn't want to rent before. A lot of those people were moving from one city to another. A lot of them were working at home. And so they wanted to rent bigger apartments if they were already renters. They wanted to rent in places like Charlotte and Orlando rather than in places like Chicago and Philadelphia. And so there was a lot more demand for rental housing. And because of that, since there wasn't a lot more supply right away, rents went way up. People were competing for the apartments that were available. So then Middleburg and other developers responded by increasing the amount of construction that we were doing, which was exactly the right thing to do. And as a result, the rent growth collapsed to either zero or negative. If you're in a situation where rents are going up and down wildly, you better have the capability to respond to conditions pretty quickly. Because if rental demand increases suddenly, then your inventory of available units is going to dry up really quickly. And people are going to walk in the door and say, I want to rent something. And you're going to say, sorry, we don't have anything for you. If, on the other hand, new supply is coming on the market regularly and you're not reducing your rents, then you're going to see a huge number of apartments that are suddenly vacant. So you need to respond to what renters want, where they want it, when they want it, and also to what other construction and development firms are building, where they're building it, when they're building it. And so my interest recently has been in doing a better job of being able to evaluate overall market conditions and respond to them very quickly so that we can maintain the inventory that we should always have for when somebody comes in and says, you know, I'd like to rent something. What do you have and how expensive is it? We want to be able to provide them the right answer to that.
So I did want to ask you about some of your prior research, just because of the kind of nature of our podcast and of Altus's business is in private real estate markets. So you've done a lot of work about the relationship between listed and unlisted. So I want to hear your take about what some of the key takeaways from a lot of that work has been. What do you think is the important thing for our listeners to know now?
Yeah. You know, I said before, Middleburg's advantage is having a better ability to evaluate the available data. We are private real estate players. A lot of people who are in private real estate have no idea that they can get good information from the public real estate market, which is to say REITs and companies like them. I'll give you an example. Back on September 11th of 2001, attack on the World Trade Center. That was an attack on travel. And what that did right away was it hammered the values of hotel properties. Now, you could see that in the days following 9/11 if you looked at the stock prices of REITs that owned hotels. You also saw it in what was happening on the private side of the market, but not until starting about 6 months later. So if you weren't paying attention to the values of hotel REIT stocks, or if you dismissed them, then you got the same information, but you waited 6 months, maybe even a year and a half to get that information. We at Middleburg aren't going to want to wait 6 months or a year and a half to get the information that other private real estate investors are sharing with us. So we do pay attention to what's happening in the listed part of the real estate market, because that gives us very quick and timely information about the conditions that we know we're going to see over the next 6 months to a year and a half. It's a very important source of information. Most people don't pay attention to it. And for a lot of those people, it's because they don't know how to pay attention to it. I'll give you an example. You mentioned upfront that I have a couple of patents. One of my patents is a way of saying, all right, let me look at what's happening to the stock prices of REITs that own, say, apartment properties, and infer from the stock price movements what has happened to the values of the apartment properties themselves, not the stock prices, the apartment properties. And so I can, on a daily basis, say, all right, conditions yesterday changed a little bit. And that tells me something has happened with the values of my properties. Now, as I mentioned before, I also have what's called a hedonic rent model. That's telling me what has changed overnight in how much people seem to be willing to pay to rent an apartment. So I have two different sources of data that are telling me what has happened to the values of the properties that my company is building and the properties that my company owns and is managing, or has invested in, you know, other properties, the properties owned by other companies. So we do have a capability of getting data that other people, maybe they have access to those data, but they don't know how to evaluate them.
So we have one question that we typically ask all of our guests. If you could snap your fingers and bring one thing, one change to the real estate industry, what do you think that would be?
I know exactly what it would be. It would be to get people to understand the possibilities that come not from tokenization of real estate, which is a dumb idea, but rather from the underlying technology that enables tokenization. Now, let me tell you what I mean by that. The underlying technology is a way of recording data that cannot be falsified. There is a huge value in using that in real estate. So if I want to buy a property, I have to spend weeks and weeks and weeks, more like months, to evaluate what are the contracts within that property, you know, the rental contracts. Who's the owner of the property? I have to do a lot of due diligence, and that due diligence is very costly and takes a lot of time. If I could simplify the process of due diligence, that would be a huge benefit to everybody in real estate. Tokenization solves a problem that doesn't exist. The idea of tokenization is that if I want to invest in a building, I can buy a share in that building without doing any due diligence. That opens me up to fraud. Tokenization is something that doesn't make sense as a way to invest in real estate. If I want to invest in a share of a building, I'm better off investing in a share of a whole portfolio of buildings. And I do that by buying a REIT that owns those buildings. So I already have the ability to invest very easily in real estate. But what I don't have is the ability to transact buildings easily and cheaply. And so if I could snap my fingers, I'd say, all right, forget the word tokenization. It's a stupid one. Now let's focus on the underlying technology, because that is very valuable.
Dr. Case, excellent answer. Thank you very much for being with us. And Omar, I think that is all the time we have for the episode today, but I want to thank you, Dr. Case, for joining us, and for our listeners for tuning in. And you guys take care until the next episode. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast, powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, tax, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.